Really? You're going to disrupt a gentleman's card game just for that? Just to tell him that he's been nominated for Vice President of the United States? In a Washington hotel, Senator Hannibal Hamlin of Maine was playing cards when there was a knock on the door, and some Republican Party bigwigs barged in. Schuyler Colfax, Zach Chandler, Benjamin Wade. "Senator Hamlin," they said, "you've been nominated by the convention in Chicago." What? Senator Hamlin was startled. The last telegram he had received was that the Westerner Abe Lincoln had bested William Seward of New York, and Hamlin liked that. He wasn't a big fan of Seward and felt a Westerner leading the ticket was better for the Republican Party. But he had also gotten the news that his balance in the election ticket, the Republicans had chosen Nathaniel Banks, the governor of Massachusetts. But now it appeared that he, Senator Hamlin, was the choice of the convention. "But gentlemen," he said, "I don't want the place." He responded in a way that was rational for a 19th century view of the vice presidency, but we wouldn't expect whoever Mitt Romney chooses for his running mate would respond this way. Now, the bigwigs, of course, told him that he simply had to take it. His presence would show that the whole nation, well, at least east and west of the nation at this time, the South had a little problem with the Republican Party in 1860, but east and west were united behind the Lincoln-Hamlin ticket. "If you refuse, Hamlin, it will be seen as a bad sign for the chances of the party." His momentary reluctance was overcome, and as he told his wife, "I was astonished as you were, dear, but I must do this for the party." His sister wrote to Hamlin, "I don't know whether congratulations or condolences are in order." Yet, whatever the feelings about the vice presidential office in the 19th century, there was still the same hubbub and excitement when a running mate was announced, and all through the north of the nation, there were now Lincoln-Hamlin torch parades. In Maine, they said Abraham Lincoln, a way of combining the two running mates' names together. And yes, Senator Hamlin was now a national figure. Time, though, would confirm Hamlin's feeling about the vice presidency. It was, he said, a nullity, the fifth wheel on the coach. During the campaign, he did little more than exchange a few letters from a worried candidate Lincoln. One said that Lincoln was annoyed by reports he was hearing in New England about how the politics were going. When Lincoln heard that Maine might go for Stephen Douglas, he responded, without saying this directly, but in a way, "Do your job, Hamlin," he said. "You must do everything possible not to let that happen." After the election, the Hamlins came to Chicago for handshakes and newspaper stories with the new president-elect, and he would soon get another Abraham Lincoln letter offering Hannibal Hamlin the choice of the one New Englander who Lincoln would put in his cabinet. That was nice. But from then on, Hamlin did little. As war raged, Hamlin, who as a senator had been a strong abolitionist, admitted that he felt the administration was moving too slow, but there was little he could do about it. In the first year, he left to go back to Maine after he hadn't heard from the president of any job for him to do. Actually, he had boarded the train too soon, though it's not likely that Lincoln's task that he had for Vice President Hamlin, counting the number of troops coming to Washington, would have been what the former senator expected himself to be doing. Indeed, Hamlin complained about the vice presidency. "As a senator, he could be helpful. As a vice president, I can be of no assistance to my friends." Lincoln's secretary John Hay noted that Hamlin was not part of presidential meetings. The presence of the second officer of the government was not seen as prudent in these meetings, he said. Hamlin may have assisted, or at least may have been consulted about Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, though that account only comes from his own story. After 4 years, he was unceremoniously dropped from the ticket in favor of Andrew Johnson, the former senator and military governor of Tennessee, as Republicans were eager to reward the border states loyal to the war effort with an East Tennessean. Lincoln was apologetic to Vice President Hamlin, so he said to him, "You have been treated badly, Hamlin, but my hands and feet are tied." Oh, indeed, Vice President Hamlin only had one purpose on that 1860 ticket: hold the East, hold New England, and balance the moderate Westerner and former Whig with a radical Easterner and former Democrat to show party harmony. He had that purpose in 1860, and it had outlived its usefulness in 1864. Sadly, a rival in Maine took an open Senate seat, denying Hamlin a comeback to the office that he really desired to have. And the same now senator blocked him from becoming Treasury Secretary of the United States. Lincoln might be forgiven for how Hamlin was handled. He did not choose him. The convention did. At different times during early American history, a presidential candidate may have had more than a say than others for whom the running mate would be. Jackson, for instance, really chose Martin Van Buren, his loyal lieutenant. But usually this was not the choice of candidate. It was the party at the convention. After a frenzied Democratic Party convention in 1912 in Baltimore, where Western progressives and conservatives in Tammany Hall, New Yorkers were sparring, William Jennings Bryan, the three-time Democratic candidate, powerful speaker, attacked the frontrunner at that convention, Champ Clark, in an attempt to stall the convention, break things up, and get, perhaps, the nomination for himself. But it didn't work. Instead, when he attacked Clark, everyone assumed that he was then backing Woodrow Wilson. Wilson's candidacy was boosted, and on some of the late ballots, he came out with momentum and won the convention. Hearing about his nomination a few hundred miles away, Wilson telephoned Congressman Burleson of Texas, one of his floor men, and said that Senator Oscar Underwood of Alabama would make a great running mate. Burleson, veteran of politics and knowledgeable about how these decisions are made, usually by the conventions, the bosses, the delegates, not by the candidate, answered, "Governor, the convention is going with Marshall." "Marshall," Wilson responded, "but he's a small caliber man." Indeed, Thomas Riley Marshall was a country lawyer and only governor of Indiana for 4 years, but he had the support of Tom Taggart, the mayor of Indianapolis, and the leader of the Indiana delegation at this convention. Taggart's support, when he switched to Wilson, was decisive and helped him get the nomination. But more than that, Indiana would be needed in a 1912 election, and thus, Marshall's job would be to carry Indiana. This wasn't new. It was the job of the previous vice presidential nominee of the Democratic Party in 1908, John Kern, to carry Indiana, and the previous Republican nominee in 1904, Charles Fairbanks, carry Indiana, and the job of the 1884 nominee of the Democratic Party, Thomas Hendricks, to carry Indiana, the job of the 1880 nominee, Charles English, carry Indiana. Such was the importance of this critical seesaw state at this time in American politics. The South was going for the Democratic Party, and the Northeast generally going for the Republican. Indeed, Route 9 running from northeastern Indiana to the Michigan border is called the Highway of Vice Presidents, reflecting the home of Marshall in Columbia City, the home of Tom Hendricks in Shelbyville, and in Huntington, the home of Vice President Dan Quayle. The combo of a country jokester who read trashy books, detective novels, and told stories, and, at the head of the ticket, the intellectual governor, former college president, the only president to have a Ph.D., was novel at the time, but the combo worked in the election. Marshall did indeed carry Indiana for the ticket, and as vice president, he went to Washington somewhat in awe. "I was impressed with the feeling of the people of America that they may have made a mistake in setting me down in the company of all these wise men of the land." But Marshall soon got used to the vice presidency. "I soon realized I was of no importance to the administration. I decided to take it in a good-humored way." He described how the guides in the U.S. Senate would take tourists through the Senate chamber and explain things to them when they would come to the vice presidential office, which he said was so small that he had to keep the door open to get any air. The guides would point out the vice president, he said, as if he was a curiosity. Finally, when one of these crowds came in, Marshall reacted. "If you look at me as though I'm a wild animal, please be kind enough to throw peanuts at me. But if you're really desirous of meeting me, come in and shake hands." Kind of a, "I am not an animal, I am a human vice president" moment. Despite the situation, Marshall would end up advancing the role of Veep more than many of his predecessors did. Wilson's absence during the peace treaty at Versailles saw the VP chairing a few cabinet meetings. That was new. World War I earned him a spot on many of the war boards that had developed, that had to be chaired by someone. And Wilson's health issues meant that Marshall, at some time, although he did not take over the running of the United States government, did have to host many of the state dinners, including the King and Queen of Belgium when they came to the White House. There was a problem there. The vice president had no residence, and Marshall's modest lodgings would not do for a king and queen. Luckily, a wealthy senator was able to provide his house. Marshall's situation was not unusual. The bottom of the ticket throughout American history has been either for some kind of party harmony reason, or, most importantly, for that regional balance, the winning of a key swing state or key swing region, responsible for the majority of running mate choices. Start with the beginning of the Republic. You're going to run John Adams of Massachusetts? Well, you need Thomas Pinckney, coastal South Carolinian, to run with him. Going to run a Virginian, Thomas Jefferson? Well, there's that up-and-coming Jay Treaty opponent, the man who's able to win as a Republican in the swing state of New York, Aaron Burr. That's the best choice. Didn't work in 1796 as a ticket, but by 1800 it did. In fact, worked so well that Burr and Jefferson ended up getting the same amount of electoral votes. When that was fixed constitutionally, James Madison was paired up with Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, Virginia, and New England. When Jimmy Monroe ran, he ran with Daniel Tompkins, governor of New York. Balance. Even when the Civil War cut off part of the South to the Republican Party, Republican tickets still showed a regional balance. New York and New England Republicans were often paired up with Midwestern Republicans. As in 1880, Garfield, Ohio, and Arthur, New York. Grant, Ohio, and Wilson, Massachusetts, 72. McKinley and Garrett Hobart of New Jersey in 1896. Hobart had the audacity to die in office. But despite that, the need for balance doesn't change, and so William McKinley of Ohio was paired with Theodore Roosevelt of New York. Oh, and when that cousin of Roosevelt's, Franklin, ran for president himself, 1932, you balanced his New Yorkness with John Nance Gardner, the Speaker of the House from Texas, who ended up comparing the vice presidency to a warm bucket of, well, this is a family program. Need for regional balance didn't change across American history. Kennedy, Johnson, 1960, same thing. Massachusetts and Texas. Dukakis, Benson, Massachusetts, Texan. Stevenson, Sparkman, 1952. You got Illinois, Alabama. When President Nixon plucked Spiro Diagnew out of obscurity, governor of Maryland, it's because he wanted to win Maryland and the border states. He knew that there was going to be a third-party candidate in 1968, George Wallace, who was going to take many of the southern states. He had to win the border states, and Agnew gets you Maryland. If Governor Romney were a 19th-century candidate, it's unlikely he'd get the choice at all. The convention would pick someone. But the modern presidential candidate does have a lot to weigh. The idea of a candidate picking the nominee, well, the candidate, if an incumbent president, may have had a role. I don't entirely believe Lincoln's comment to Senator Hamlin that his hands were completely tied in picking Johnson. I think he liked that choice as well, to pick a Union-supporting war Democrat from Tennessee. But in terms of when this started to be the candidate's choice, I would say look at Franklin Roosevelt, 1940, after two terms, put his foot down, and made his choice progressive former Republican Henry Wallace, Secretary of Agriculture, implementing a New Deal program, like the way he thought, even though the Democratic bosses and some of the Southern senators objected to the choice. Either pick 'em, Roosevelt said, or no deal, I don't run for a third term. Wallace ended up annoying the senators and conservatives as vice president, and in 1944, he was bounced from the ticket and became Secretary of Commerce. Harry S. Truman, acceptable to FDR, but picked by the bosses, most notably Kansas City's Tom Pendergast, was named a vice presidential nominee. Dewey, the New Yorker in 1944, was teamed up with Ohioan John Bricker, the old New York-Ohio regional balance in the Republican Party, still in full effect in the 1940s. Win the war quicker with Dewey and Bricker, they said. That kind of didn't work. I would say that 1952 on the Republican side, and now you are really establishing that idea that it is a nominee like Eisenhower who chooses his number two, though there's always, to this day, influences on that decision. Here's what Eisenhower said about 52. I had a list of several men, and Dick Nixon of California was on the top. His political philosophy coincided with my own. Next, I realized that before the election would take place, I would reach 62. I thought that we should take this opportunity to select a candidate who was young and vigorous. Aside from that, the question of communist influence in our government had been a strong one, and Mr. Nixon had conducted himself well in televised hearings, both as a successful prosecutor, but also at all times fair. Now, what Eisenhower said is partially true, except that before he made his list, where Nixon was first on it, Henry Cabot Lodge had already begged off. He was running for Senate in 1952 against John Kennedy, and as it would turn out, he would lose. Thomas E. Dewey, the previous candidate, also swore off being Eisenhower's number two. So Eisenhower had just beaten Robert Taft of Ohio, a conservative and the leader of that wing of the party, and with that defeat went some real bad feelings between these two camps. Taft led those conservatives, and the Eastern Republicans had backed Eisenhower. Nixon was expected to support Taft during that presidential primary because Nixon was a conservative senator from California, but he chose the former World War II general instead. He thought he would just be a better candidate and a better leader for foreign affairs. This made him a bridge between the two Republican factions. He was good friends with conservative stalwart Bill Nolan, the other senator from California who had supported Taft, and would end up nominating Nixon at the convention and could bridge those two sides. But the choice of who to name, despite all these political considerations, was Eisenhower's to make. Yet that didn't mean that Nixon just simply leaped into it. Not unlike his 19th century predecessor, Senator Hamblin, there was trepidation a little on the part of Senator Nixon. Nixon was an up-and-coming senator. He just won in 1950, and his name started showing up in newspaper articles, and when Eisenhower's people had some preliminary discussions with him, he sought out the advice of Alice Longsworth, a veteran of Washington, D.C. politics, and her real name, Alice Roosevelt Longsworth. This was Theodore Roosevelt's daughter and wife of a former Speaker of the House, very knowledgeable about politics. She told Nixon, "Father used to say that it was the most boring job in the world, the vice presidency. If Ike gets the nomination, though, someone will have to go on the ticket and ensure party regulars that he will not take the party to hell in a handcart. And you are the best man to do that. But if you're thinking about your own career, Richard, you are probably better off to stay in the Senate and not become some non-entity that served as vice president." Even in the 1950s, that was the view of the office. Nixon did get that call, and he did accept it. But Eisenhower made clear to Richard Nixon, "I want you to be part of the team and be ready to be president should something happen to me." He held to the promise. And Nixon was elevated to the more active VP that we know today, was the first VP since Van Buren to get the chance to run for president after two full terms of the president he served for had been completed, elevated the office. Party harmony was behind the Nixon choice. It's a common reason for tickets, just as common as regional balance, and often mixed up in the two because politicians in different regions often become factions. In 1928, when Democrats chose Al Smith, the governor of New York, an urban, anti-prohibition, pro-liquor politician, wet, they chose Senator Joe Robinson of Arkansas, a dry, to balance out the factions. In 1940, Republicans turned to newcomer Wendell Willkie, who hadn't been involved in Republican politics that much up to that point. They made sure to put Charles McNary on the ticket. He was a regular Republican, and he was in the House leadership. Tickets such as Garfield Arthur in 1880 got that kind of stalwart half-breed mix. Davis Bryan, 1924, mixing the conservatives and the progressives. Cleveland Hendricks in 1884. Cleveland was that reform governor of New York, and Hendricks was an old party man. Johnson Humphrey in 1964. Johnson, conservative. Humphrey, the liberals loved him. Carter Mondale. Carter was from the South and had taken the party away. Mondale was old guard, liberal Democrat. Reagan, the conservative. Bush, the moderate. Hoover, Curtis. Hoover was the new progressive type of Republican of the 1920s. Curtis was a party man. Ford, Dole. Ford was the president who was a moderate Republican and had almost been beaten by Reagan. Dole was the conservative chosen to appease the conservatives in the party. This happens quite often. And certainly, the announcement of the ticket, that is a moment that you can give something back to a part of the party that you may have annoyed by winning its nomination. and you have an opportunity to make it the whole party speaking. These are no doubt factors on Mitt Romney's mind at this point. Doesn't mean it's always going to go well. In 1896, the Democratic Party did something radical. They did not invite the sitting president to the National Convention. Now, that part's not radical, but they did not nominate him. And they did not even pass a resolution thanking President Grover Cleveland for his work. With the economy in a terrible recession and the president refusing to get behind the coinage of silver that this convention wanted, the convention rejected him and nominated silverite William Jennings Bryan, congressman of Nebraska, a great orator and leader of the silver forces. Then they did something else. They named Arthur Sewell of Maine to the second post. He was not well known. He was a member of the Democratic National Committee and a wealthy man who had run for Senate in Maine as a Democrat, but that was a strong Republican state. He did not win. But as a member of the Democratic National Committee, he had always supported the coinage of silver. So he was acceptable to Bryan and the others. He was not acceptable to a third party, the Populist Party. Now, the Populist Party in 1892 had made a run for the White House and won the electoral votes of several states. The Democrats wanted the support of that Populist Party, and by nominating Bryan, they were going towards earning it. They liked Bryan, these populists, and Bryan could get their votes. In fact, the party's candidate in 1892 was General James Weaver, and he himself, in the 1896 Populist Party convention, put William Jennings Bryan's name in nomination to have both the Democratic and Populist Party tickets. But they would not take Arthur Sewell. They had their own candidate, Thomas Watson of Georgia, a known populist. Bryan was emphatic in his support for his running mate, however, and told the newspapers, "If they, the populists, do not take Sewell, I will decline their nomination." But for the Populist Party, it didn't matter. Despite this statement, they nominated Bryan anyway. In fact, General James Weaver said, as he nominated Bryan, he appreciated Bryan's manly statement, but felt that this question has reached a point where Mr. Bryan has no say on what the convention should do. And they nominated William Jennings Bryan for the Populist Party, not anyway, with Tom Watson for vice president. Now what do? You've got this nomination. Do you refute it? Well, Arthur Sewell stepped in and insisted in a telegram to Bryan that he not do anything in Sewell's interest and that he accept at once both the Populist and Democratic Party nominations despite the presence of two different vice presidential running mates. Oh, Bryan would write later that he could laugh it off a little bit. It may have helped him to have two vice presidents out there working for him, but it was an embarrassing episode that wasted time and interrupted the image of leadership a presidential candidate wishes to convey then as much as now. Regional balance, party harmony explain most nominees in American history, but not all. When Democrats met in 1920 and nominated James Cox of Ohio, the vice presidential nominee was Franklin Roosevelt. A year after his cousin's death, the party thought that the Roosevelt name would add some punch. Theodore Roosevelt had been a Republican. Now here was a Roosevelt who was a Democrat. So we can add another reason for choices based on that 1920 election and a few others. PR, public relations, buzz, you might say. Indeed, the nomination of the first Roosevelt had an air of this as well. In 1900, Theodore Roosevelt was chosen straight from the battlefields of Cuba in the Spanish-American War, leader of the Rough Riders, a guy who got a lot of press. He would help back up President McKinley in the 1900 election. In 1920, Calvin Coolidge was chosen. There was some regional balance there, the Ohio leading ticket of Warren Harding, but also some public relations reasons. See, he had put down a police strike in Boston, and he was seen as a proponent of law and order in a time of strikes, riots, and violence, 1920, when the Republican Party was running on normalcy. Who better than Calvin Coolidge, governor of Massachusetts, to influence that message? One more comment about 1920. It's known that a smoke-filled back room made Warren Harding president. But it's not as well known that the choice of number two was not part of that back room. Indeed, the bosses at the 1920 convention who got Harding the nomination wanted a senator from Wisconsin to be the choice. and papers were distributed out the convention to delegates, starting with the Oregon delegates. Frustrated supporters of the candidates that had lost to Harding now revolted and started mentioning Calvin Coolidge. The applause at the convention for him was real as his name was put in nomination. Voting for Calvin Coolidge became a statement against the bosses. And as a member of no faction in particular, Cal Coolidge had no ill will associated with him. Calvin Coolidge was the first vice president in 100 years not to be wished on the country by a party, but to be wished on the party by the country, said the Boston Globe. The chairman of the convention, who had attended every Republican convention ever, from 1856, the party's first one, to 1920, told Coolidge that he had never seen as spontaneous and enthusiastic tribute like the one he saw for Coolidge that day. So Coolidge provided some regional balance, but there were other people they could go to for that in 1920. They could have gone to Lodge, senator from Massachusetts. They went to Coolidge for PR, for buzz. This is what Adlai Stevenson tried to do in 1956. He was running again against Eisenhower. Now Eisenhower was president. He had already lost to him in 1952. There was no surprise there. So on live TV at the convention, Stevenson threw the choice of who would be vice president to that convention. This was exciting, and it brought two new candidates to the battle. Estes Kefauver and John F. Kennedy competed for who would get that number two spot. Kennedy didn't win it, but it gave him a national name that he would use later. It's helpful when you were down, earning the nomination in 1984. Walter Mondale knew he had a long way to go to beat President Reagan. So to his vice presidential choice, he wanted to have a big news story and do something radical. He had three ideas. Mayor Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, an African-American. Henry Cisneros of San Antonio, Hispanic mayor. Radical step for 1984. Or Geraldine Ferraro, congresswoman from Queens, New York. Any one of these three would have made history. And as we knew, Mondale chose Ferraro. This leads us to the very last election. It had been John McCain's plan from the beginning to do something radical to shake up the election of 2008, which up to that point had been just nonstop press attention to the two Democratic candidates competing in that long primary, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. According to some reports, he knew just what he wanted to do. Name a Democrat, well, technically now an independent, Joe Lieberman. He was told by his advisors this would annoy the convention, particularly considering Lieberman's view on abortion. He was told the party probably wouldn't accept it and it would be an ugly floor fight. Nevertheless, McCain found a way to get some PR, some buzz. In a great convention, probably one of the best conventions to boost a candidate in recent history, a new type of candidate shook up things and stripped the Obama-Biden campaign of momentum, badly needed. For a few weeks, it could have been considered one of the best vice presidential picks ever. The momentum, though, did not last, and Sarah Palin, the surprise choice, the governor of Alaska, ended up with a few embarrassing TV performances, perhaps turned off some voters, perhaps stole some attention from the top of the ticket. But a lot of that is hindsight. We had a major financial crash during that election, which people forget about now looking at their race. It can be said that you're not going to get too much more out of a vice presidential pick in terms of buzz than that one in 2008. I don't think it can be topped anytime soon. We'll see. On the other side of the aisle, did Joe Biden produce a buzz, clamor, thrill? Was it Delaware's electoral votes? Could Biden really be said to represent a faction of the party? No, no, and no. For that matter, did George W. Bush pick Richard B. Cheney in 2000 in order to win Wyoming? Not likely. So there is another factor that really represents the modern evolution of the vice president now, and that we must consider. The guy who flies in Air Force Two, lives at the Naval Observatory, and lunches with a leader of the free world, a mentor, an ombudsman, fix-it man, right-hand man in many cases, sometimes the guy who holds the important meetings, the running mate who makes up for a perceived weakness in the nominee. One of these quite often is Washington experience. Voters aren't always as interested in this, but the media, the thought leaders, the guys who are going to produce spin, who are going to constantly fire questions at you, the meet the press crowd do value it highly. Congressional leaders expect it. But voters lately have preferred their top ticket candidates to be outsiders, governors. So who do you add to the Clinton ticket? You add Senator Albert Gore of Tennessee, and to this governor of Arkansas, you get an arms control expert. And you're running Governor George W. Bush of Texas, you add Richard B. Cheney, and you have a consummate insider, former defense secretary. And I also think it's fairly clear that you add Senator Joe Biden with years of experience in the Senate to match up Barack Obama, who, although a senator, only been a senator for a few years. Biden knows the Hill. Jimmy Carter in 1976 chooses Mondale, and you get, yes, regional balance, North and South. Yes, you get party regular versus party insurgent, yes. But it's also balancing a one-term governor of Georgia with an experienced veteran who can sit and have meetings with the senators. So you can see in my classification that there's these neat little categories, right? Regional balance, factional harmony, PR and buzz, or compensation to make up for a perceived weakness in the top ticket. It's not so easy. There's a mixture with this, and I think the best running mate choices will mix many of these factors. You choose Lyndon Johnson, for instance, in 1960, chiefly on a regional basis. The Kennedy people needed Johnson to win particularly Texas, but also to hold the rest of the South if they had any chance of beating Richard Nixon. But it's functional, too. Johnson is that congressional old side of the party, aligned with Sam Rayburn and others. The Kennedy team is the new side. 1920, Coolidge is different, it's buzz, but it still does the job of Massachusetts and Ohio regional balance. 1952, Nixon, as we said, wins you those Taft people, party harmony reason, right? But also, California's electoral votes were a factor in that election. Palin creates a buzz for John McCain, but at the same time, delighted party conservatives who may have been disappointed with some of McCain's positions in the past. President Obama's campaign liked Biden for all the reasons of beefing up the gravitas on the ticket, but I think saw some regional potential as well in Biden's closeness to Pennsylvania and the electoral votes there. So we can say that these four categories aren't clear: regional balance, factional harmony, PR and buzz, or compensation for weakness, that there's often a mixture. One factor is usually the most prominent explanation for running mate choice. There are a few rarer reasons. Sometimes a candidate wants to simply reinforce a message. So 1992, Bill Clinton picks Al Gore. You've got two people from neighboring states. It's not regional balance at all. You've got two moderates, so it's not party harmony at all. You've got a little bit of that, you know, backing up the gravitas on the ticket because Al Gore had been a senator for a while at this point and Clinton was the governor of a small state. But I also think it was sending a double message. Using that VP running mate as an opportunity to send a double message. You know, the joke was double Bubba when the ticket was announced. This is a new party. The Southerners are in charge. 1936, this happened too. The Republican ticket of Landon Knox attempted this. They were two progressive Republicans. Alf Landon was the governor of Kansas. 24 years prior, they had stomped for Theodore Roosevelt when the party was split up in 1912. So it wasn't party harmony at all. It was two people from the progressive side of the party. It was sending a double message. This is the direction we're taking the party this year. Didn't end up working. 1964, Goldwater said, Congressman Miller, obscure congressman from New York, is a conservative just like me, and that's what you're getting in this election. Two firm conservatives. I'm going to reinforce the message. That can happen sometimes. You know, there are some personal choices as well. Humphrey chooses Muskie in 1968. It was a raucous convention, and he had a couple other choices. There was a senator from Oklahoma that might have provided regional balance in 1968, but with that convention and the disruption going on, Humphrey just wanted a solid choice. And Muskie was a no-mistake choice, and everybody saluted the choice, even if it didn't do tremendous good in terms of party harmony or regional balance. Since the beginning of the Republic, most commonly it's one of those four factors, though. Everyone wonders now who Mitt Romney will choose to be his vice presidential nominee. I say you still got to look at them. Despite modern times, TV, the internet, regional balance has not gone away as the Electoral College has not gone away. And in this election, one state may be important. You know, you can go with Governor O'Donnell in Virginia and try for that state. Then you know he's choosing for regional balance. If he picks Paul Ryan, you know he's going for that party harmony reason. Bob Portman, a little bit regional, but also going for that need to shore up his Washington insider credentials. But you've got choices that might mix many of these. You go with a choice such as Mark Rubio. He's going to help you win Florida. He creates buzz because he's going to be the first Latino candidate, and that'll help you with the party. He's liked by the Tea Party people, so you've got some party harmony there, too. So he has a lot of different factors at once. Of course, Florida's an important swing state. The one problem you'd have with the Rubio pick, which may well occur, is a problem with really creating PR and buzz because it's such a predicted play right now. I hear some radical choices out there. A lot of hoopla about Condoleezza Rice. That kind of got out, and I think she refused the ticket already. There's been talk about something crazy like the governor of Puerto Rico choosing him. What a buzz that would create, just like the Palin ticket. One thing that I think is that Romney surprised a lot of people, myself included, with how quickly he shored up the nomination, considering the strength of the conservatives in the party and Romney's image really not being there. So it doesn't appear to me that party harmony is a goal right now, and I think it would have been a mistake to go after that too clearly. There's a lot of reasons for Republicans to be against President Obama, so that's not going to be, I think, important. If he chooses for that reason, it would be a big mistake. Therefore, I think you go to two important things. There's that old regional balance, and choosing someone from Florida, I think, makes as much sense as any play, because the Electoral College being what it is, Romney's going to have to win Florida and Ohio to take this thing. I also think, given the kind of standstill that you have in the presidential race and the ability of the president to use a Rose Garden strategy, keep announcing things, and take up all the news, there's a temptation for a campaign to create a lot of buzz. And so I would not be surprised if that's what he goes with. He can do it in two ways. Susana Martinez, a very new governor of New Mexico, but any Latino choice is going to produce buzz for the campaign. If, despite the governor's refusal, he picks Chris Christie of New Jersey, you've got that kind of double-barreled approach, a message of two of the same type of person running and that the party's going in a slightly different direction. We will await Mitt Romney's choice for who will be his vice presidential running mate. As observers of history and politics, we know the choice is not new, and the factors that he makes the choice based on are very similar to those in the first competitive election of 1796. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. Listen to us on iTunes. I've got a link there to Stitcher, where you can listen to the program on whatever mobile app device that you have. And it's very important, if you do like the program, please tell someone about it. You know, post a note on your blog, post a comment on iTunes, rate the show on iTunes, or select as helpful some of the other good comments about the program on iTunes. That always helps. I want to thank you for listening.